Welcome to Parshanut of the Rishonim, and we will get to know a number of commentaries that are listed here, but especially Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Ramban. Okay, we'll discuss the relationship with one another. But today, as the syllabus reads, material is used by the Rishonim. Okay, what did Rashi have in front of him that made him wake up one day and say, you know, I'm going to write a commentary? Did Rashi institute something that was a chiddush? And if he did, what was the need for such a chiddush at that time? Because what was available to anyone in 11th century France, by the way, my name is Alan Schwartz. It's great to be here. I just started teaching again at Stern 2 years ago, and it's really a machaya. This is my 80th straight semester teaching at YU. And this closes out 40 years, so it's a real momentous time for me. So thanks for being here. 40 years. So before Rashi wrote his commentary, what was available to a Jew who wanted to make a Dvar Torah on the Parsha, right, was Gemara, Shas Bavli Rishonim, right? A series of Midrashim, divided into two, Midrash Halacha, Midrash Agada. You can understand the difference between the two, right? They were Midrashim, whose sole purpose was to interpret the Halacha from the Pesukim. That's before Mishnah, before Rebbe. Right? If you wanted to know how to eat the Korban Pesach, you had to go to Parshas Bo and look at the Pesukim. Right? That was not so convenient because Pesach is mentioned in a whole bunch of places in the Torah. You would have to look in Parshas Emor in the Sifra to see what Emor has to say about Pesach. And you might want to look in the Sifrei to Parshas Re'ei because Pesach is mentioned in this week's Parsha too that teaches some things that the other two books don't have. Right, so you see, Rebbe codified that. And let's put it all into something called Maseches Pesachim. Get it? Okay. So by the time you get up to the Shas Bavli and the Yerushalmi, some questions about Pesach can appear amazingly in other Maseches. Yuma has some things about Pesach that Pesachim doesn't have. Chagig and Bava Kama have stuff about Shabbos that Maseches Shabbos doesn't have. So see if you can fit this in the historical blank that I'm about to leave for you. What Rebbe did to the Medrashei Halacha, blank did to Gemara. What Rebbe did to the Medrashei Halacha, this individual did to the Gemara. The answer is, even before the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is a correct answer, but someone did it before the Shulchan Aruch. That would be the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam. Gabriella?
Rudy, I just registered.
Oh, what is your last name?
Wimelgreen.
Okay, I have you in my other class.
What?
I have you in my other class.
Philosophy of
food.
Yeah, I just switched.
Switched? Okay. I don't like crossing out names. I'm just going to put it in parentheses. Okay. So you everyone get that? The Rambam codified all of the laws of Shabbos, even if it doesn't appear in the Sefer Shabbos. It appears in the Sefer Bava Kama, other than the Sefer spoke about the laws of Shabbos too. Right? Okay, so what Rashi had available to him was Shas Bavli Yerushalmi, Medrashei Halacha, right? There are three Medrashei Halacha. Right? Have you been exposed to that? Just remember the names now, okay? The Medrash Halacha to Shmos is called the Mechilta. The Medrash Halacha to Vayikra is called Sifra, the book. Sifra. Vayikra has more mitzvahs than Bamidbar and Dvarim put together. Vayikra, Sifra, the book. Bamidbar and Dvarim are together in one book called Sifrei, which means books. Sifrei, Bamidbar and Dvarim, Vayikra, Sifra, Mechilta, Shmos. Bereishis does not have a Medrash Halacha. Can anyone tell me why? Why wouldn't Bereshis have a Medrash Halacha?
Because it doesn't have halacha.
It's not about much halacha. We need to make a whole Medrash just on Bris Milah, Givat Anoshe, and Puravu. That's only three mitzvahs in all of Bereshis. Yeah? Okay. Good. So Rashi has, now get it, Shas Bavli Rishalmi, Medrash Halacha, just three of them. But there's a plethora of Medrash Agodah. Okay, can you name any? You know, are you familiar with any? Medrash Agodah. There's a lot that Rashi quotes in his writings. Are you familiar with Bereshis Rabba?
Yeah.
Medrash Rabba, right? Medrash Tanchuma, right? Medrash Mishle, Medrash Shmuel, right? There were some collections of Midrashim available to Rashi, known as Yalkutim, Yalkut. Yalkut means a collection, right? Backpack of Midrashim that Rashi might have had. Okay? So Rashi has a whole history, and not to mention Targum. Targum Onkelos to the Torah, Targum Yonasan to the Nevi'im. And there are some very Midrashic Targumim to Ksuvim. Okay, there are Targumim. You all know what I mean by Targum, right? The Aramaic translations of the Tanakh. So this is all that Rashi had available to him. Just by an educated guess, or if you know. From the sources I just mentioned, I'll repeat them, Shas Bavli Yerushalmi, Mechilta Sifros Sifrei, Medrash Rabba, Medrash Tanchuma, and a whole host of other Medrashei Agadah. Are you going to get Pshat or Drash from these sources? Medrashei Drash, the word Drash is in there, Medrashei Halacha. You're going to get Drash from these things, right? You're not getting Pshat, right? In the entire Talmud Bavli, only three times does the Gemara say, well, what's the pshat of this thing? The Talmud Bavli is not interested in pshat, they're interested in drash. Okay, what's the difference between pshat and drash? This is very much in the United States debates about how to interpret the U.S. Constitution, right? What's the best way to interpret the U.S. Constitution or anything you say?
The spirit of it.
Spirit of it. What else do people usually say?
What it says literally.
Okay, the literal meaning.
What the forefathers had in mind.
Maybe what the author had in mind. Maybe what they had in mind is different from what we have in mind. But we have to live today. We can't live. Right. This is hotly debated about guns and abortion and other things of that sort that might have been very different 250 years ago, and it's going to be different for us too when interpreting text as well, right? So usually what they say about the Constitution is the plain literal meaning. Usually they say the plain, don't embellish, right? So the question I would like to deal with today, and I'd like hopefully by the end of this class that you all feel comfortable with two different answers to this question, is why is it that if Jews were studying the biblical text, not just Torah, but Nevi'im and Ksuvim, not just Nevi'im and Ksuvim, but also Torah, that if Jews were satisfied to study the biblical text from the sources I just mentioned, which you all agreed is more in the realm of drash than pshat, right? What happened around the time of Rashi that made almost everybody who wrote a commentary at that point pursue pshat?
The disputations.
Okay, we'll get to that. Through my Yishayahu class last semester, that came up. Okay. But does everybody acknowledge the question? Did someone just wake up one day and say, "Hey, it's 1070. Let's learn pshat." Okay. To be fair, I left out one important commentary in between. I don't know if I should call him a commentary. It's Rav Sadia Gaon. You've heard of him? Mm-hmm. Sadia Gaon, 100 plus years before Rashi. It was certainly a worthwhile commentary, but it was not written as a commentary. It was written as a translation of the Torah. Okay. What's a tzardeya? Frog. Everybody agree with that? No? Sadigon says its farde is a crocodile. Okay. What would make him say such a thing? Right? I'm just saying, it's a commentary, but it's started off as a translation. Right? Translation ends up being commentary. Right? But remember, the Torah is not just literature. Ayin tachas ayin may translate as an eye for an eye. Right? Can you say an eye for an eye some other way in Hebrew? Use the two words ayin and some other word besides tachas. What would you come up with?
You say ayin
la ayin? Ayin la ayin. Maybe even ayin be ayin. Ayin tmuras ayin. More complicated word maybe. Which means instead of. Okay. Ayin tachas ayin, the Gemara in Bava Kama darshins to mean, it's the Torah's way of saying that no, you would not, if I, even with intent, took out someone's eye, I would have to pay for that. I wouldn't be punished by having my eye taken. You're familiar with that halacha, right? It's not ayin tachas, an eye for an eye. You know, we used to think Old Testament judgment is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. No, no. That person didn't know the Gemara in Bava Kama. Right? That it might even be hinted in the word tachas, right? Now, if you're the Vilna Gaon, right? Vilna Gaon could rip anything he wanted from the biblical text, right? You see the word ayin? What are the letters under that? Yeah, tachas means under. What's the letter under an ayin? In the letter right before it. Samach. He means the letter after. Tachas means under. It means Aleph, Beis. Get Beis is under Aleph. Gimel is under Beis. Gimel. What's the letter after Ayin? Oh. Pei. What's the letter after Yud? What's the letter after Nun? Now, just mix that up a little bit, and what do you get? Kesef. Right? Money instead of the eye. Pay for the eye. Right? Now, would you call that pshat? No, I wouldn't even call that drash. Right? A quick difference between pshat and drash. Would anyone like to take a try at it? What's the difference between pshat and drash? Also, very much on the table now in constitutional circles. Who's the pashtun of the U.S. Constitution, liberal or the conservative?
Conservative.
Right, the conservatives are often saying, we want the plain literal meaning of the Constitution. And the liberal says, no, we want some, we have to interpret it, we have to be more and more interpretive, right? Okay, so use that to interpret the difference between the word pshat and drash.
Would pshat just be like, exactly what's better. Drash is just like what you see within it, like
their opinion
on what that actually means.
Okay, that's certainly a worthwhile difference. Now let's look at the etymology. Lahafshit. Lahafshit means to skin an animal. It's one of the 39 malachas. Right? They had leather works in the Mishkan, and they had to skin animals. So pshat is the skin layer explanation of this thing. Drash is, give me a good English word now, a deeper. Darashta v'chakarta hitev. Drisha v'chakira. Are you familiar with those terminologies? Lachkor means to dig deeper. Right? Okay? So, pshat is the skin layer meaning of this thing. Drash is a deeper meaning. Okay? Tippy? There's a third word that often enters Rashi's interpretation. Listen to it now. You may not have been schooled in the difference between pshat and this word. It's called mashma'ut. Mashma'ut. You ever see Rashi sometimes writes pshuto kimashma'o? those must be two different words, because Rashi wouldn't say pshuto kipshuto. Pshuto kemashma'o, pshat and mashma'ut must mean two different things according to Rashi. Because he writes this quite often. The pshuto kemashma'o. So what's the difference? Pshat means the simplest skin layer meaning of this is the... Some of you captured this already. Mashma'ut means open up a dictionary, look at the verbal meaning of this word. Because the Torah is written in very flowery expressions. Very often one word appears when you would have expected a different word. Rashi establishes this rule in his first commentary to the Torah. I shouldn't say the first, second commentary. What does the word Bereishis mean? I don't want to mean to put you on the spot. Most students do not get the meaning of Bereishis right. What does it mean? Think carefully. What is the meaning of the word Bereishis? Well, most people say in the beginning, but that's not correct. Bereishis. Okay, you got it right. Of. Bereishis means in the beginning of. In the head of. Bereishis is a construct. How do you say in the beginning in Hebrew? Bereishona. The first word of the Torah should have been Bereishona bara Elokim es hashamayim es haaretz. So Rashi's drash is, so why does it say Bereishis? Why do you mean the construct? Rashi's interpretation is that there's something missing in the pasuk. In the beginning of creation, God created heaven and earth. There's something missing in the pasuk according to Rashi. Okay, you hear it? Rashi acknowledges, and this is his great gift, this is why he's so popular, is that since the Torah is divine, he's going to be, get this terminology, a close reader. He's going to be very closely examining every word. Why did you use this word when a different word would have been better? Why did you use two words when one word would have been fine? Okay, I'm going to give you some exercises now. Let's work at it, okay? Sarah is taken into Paro's private quarters, right? He thinks she's not a married woman. After all, Avram said so. And he starts to make a move on her, right? Okay. The Torah does not tell us what Sarah said at that point, but it does tell her that he never actually got to touch her, right? Because it says, Vayinaga Hashem es Paro, al dvar Sarai eshes Avram. Okay. God afflicted Paro, al dvar Sarai eshes Avram. Now, the mashma'ut of the rest of that pasuk should read, God afflicted Paro, and is it the mashma'ut? It's a little extraneous in Hebrew, doesn't it? Don't you think? Al-dvar. Give me the mashma'ut. Not the pshat, but the mashma'ut. Translate those words precisely.
On the word?
I wouldn't say on the speech of Sarah, but that's what Rashi says. But
on the
give me pshat. Come on. Say pshat. Don't give me pshat. Give me the mashma'ut of the way you would translate this, speaking in normal English. God afflicted Paro.
Because Sarah was the Abraham's wife.
Okay, but that's not the plain meaning of this pasuk. Give me good English on the what?
Words.
I wouldn't say it that way. That's what Rashi ends up doing with the pasuk, because the alvar should have been much easier Hebrew words. Ba'avur, biglal, bishvil, odot. Can you hear it in Hebrew? Vayinaga Hashem es Paro, ba'avur sarai eshes Avram. Biglal sarai eshes Avram. Bishvil sarai eshes Avram. Odot sarai eshes. There are plenty of good Hebrew, biblical Hebrew words to put in there rather than use two words. But now, in English, try to translate that. God afflicted Paro. How about this? On the matter of... Right? It's an unusual Hebrew form. It doesn't translate well. Right? Okay? So that's what Dalia said, that it means on the word of Sarai Eshes Avram. Anybody know what Rashi writes about this?
Yeah.
Paro made a move on her. That's what, and she said, "Now this is fabricated. This is in the Medrash, Shrava. But whenever a Medrash says something, there's always something in the Pasuk, usually something in the Pasuk, that makes the Medrash say this. We're going to learn this when we read Rashi. Okay? The Medrash says that she told Paro this. My husband did what he did, but I have to tell you, that's my husband. It's not my brother. We're married. Paro said, get out of here. And he started to make a move on her. Right? What is in the Pasuk? I'm going to say the Pasuk again, that might make the Medrash explain that Sarah identified herself as a married woman. Listen to the Pasuk again. Vayenaga Hashem es Paro al dvar Sarai Eishes Avram. Eishes Avram, why did you have to say that? I know Sarah is Avram's wife. That's the story. That's what's happening here. The Torah already told me two or three times that Sarah and Avram are married. You hear? So why does the Torah have to remind me of something I already know? So the Midrash picks up that ball and says, what did Sarah do? She told Paro, I'm a married woman, please don't do this. And Paro didn't back off. So what did Sarah do then? You know the Rashi, go ahead. What? Yes, she, Al-Dvar, sorry, she's Avram. Now she prayed, she called upon God, Al-Dvar, by the word of Sarah, Paro was stricken. Is that the pshat of this pasuk? It's not.
No, it's drash.
Why did Rashi bring down such a drash? Come on, stay with me here. Why did the Torah say Al-Dvar instead of these easier Hebrew words? Rashi approaches the biblical text by saying, if the Torah could have used one word, don't use two. And if it uses two, finish my sentence.
It means something.
It must mean something extra that doesn't jump out at you in pshat. Okay? I must tell you, Rashi's own grandson, Rashbam, was codified in Mikros Gedolos, and especially Ibn Ezra, were very critical of Rashi for writing these kind of things. Don't write what's not in the pasuk. Okay? They said. We'll learn this. This is part of what we'll learn. Okay? I want you to get this. I want to make sure you get this. Okay? I think there are two things I can use to underscore the difference between pshat and mashma'ut. Okay? Two things. One is humor. Okay? And one is advertisements. Advertisements tend to rely on double entendre. Let me explain. This is part of remember I took a writing course at YU and this came up and showing us certain advertisements. And he said, the advertisement was a picture of a vodka bottle and it says, this vodka will leave you breathless. Now, you heard that word just now. What is the pshat of breathless?
Breathe.
What?
I can't breathe.
Okay. Now, that's the mashma'ut of breathless. But what does the guy writing this, the person writing this ad...
Blown away.
Yeah, blown away. I can't catch my breath. This is so good. Right? Now, it's true that the word breathless can mean dead. Right? But I can't believe that suicidal vodka drinkers are going to pay for an ad to tell people to drink this vodka and die. That's great. Who's going to spend money doing such a thing? So breathless can't mean without breath at all. It's more likely that it means to be able to catch your breath because it really takes my breath away. Have you heard that sort of saying, right? Right? Someone tells you take my breath away, you mean I kill you? So, there are idiomatic things where we mean things that, you know, come on, you know, if you say something in a different language, you can, in a different culture, you could be saying the wrong thing, right? Because there are idiomatic phrases, like al-dvar sarai, right? Which translates as because of sarai. But Rashi, who felt that if that's what it means, you should have used the one word, right? So if you use two words, I'm going to say that this pasuk is telling me more than that. I hope you're all getting this, right? Okay. But I never knew this, and I hope you didn't either, that when you drink scotch or whiskey or alcoholic beverages to excess, everybody around you on the train and everybody in class is going to know you've been drinking. Right? They can smell your breath from 6 feet away. Except vodka. Very good vodkas, you could drink 2 bottles and it has the same effect on your breath as water. The better the vodka is. Now you get a different interpretation of this vodka will leave you breathless. Really good vodka. You could drink as much as you want, you go home and no one knows you've been drinking. Right? So I didn't know that. I certainly don't know about it firsthand, but that is now you see a new what was that? Is it a shot? No, because it's maybe the mashma'ut of the word breathless. We just gave 3 mashma'uyot to the word breathless. Right? Can't catch my breath. Oh my goodness, this is so good. I gotta calm down. Phew. 2 is dead, but we dismiss that. 3 is, it's not revealed on your breath. Now that's, you see that's like how advertisements try to, you know, get you a double entendre or something. You can hear it. And humor uses this also. Right? The mushroom walks into a bar and says, can I have a drink? And the bartender says, sorry, we don't serve your type here. He goes, why not? I'm a fungi. What sometimes makes something very funny is where you know, right? Okay, it doesn't matter how corny it is. It's just that it's you know, okay. Which is the pshat and which is the drash in this particular joke? Well, show me you're getting this. In other words, the mushroom wants a drink. Because in a bar, usually, you know, what's wrong with my cut type? So what is the pshat of what he means?
But his type is a mushroom, he should be
in
a bar.
I think that's the drash, no? In other words, why wouldn't you just serve me a drink? I'm a pretty fun guy, F-U-N-G-U-Y, right? Now, I've never met a mushroom that's a fun guy, but the mushroom happens to be a fun guy, F-U-N-G-H-I. Now you're getting it, right? Okay. So, in other words, you should serve me a drink. I'm a fun guy. I'm with fun to this bar. Right? More people want to come. So you should serve me. Okay. Are you starting to get the difference between pshat and mashmaut here? Okay. Pshuto kamashmao is Rashi saying the plain meaning of these words is the verbal meaning of what you're looking at. See if you can get this exercise now. There's one book of Tanakh, only one book of Tanakh, where Rashi writes the following. He writes the terminology Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto about 100 times in his commentary. In only one book he writes Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto U'Mashma'o. You must, in order to really appreciate this book, accept the pshat of this book as well as the mashma'ut of this book. What book am I talking about? Show me that you're getting everything we did in the last 15 minutes. What book must that be? Where if you disregard the mashma'ut of this book, you'll lose out. It must be a book where some others fail to recognize the mashma'ut of this book. Of course, yes! Good. I want to make sure everyone got that. It's Shir HaShirim. Rashi introduces his commentary to Shir HaShirim by saying, in order to read this book, you must appreciate Ki Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto U'Mashma'o. Because on the face of it, it's a story of a man and a woman. The deeper meaning is the story of the love between God and his people. But if you forget the simple pshat, you will not get this book. Right? If you forget the mashma'ut of learning about it's about a man and a woman, you will fail to recognize the deeper meaning of the book. So Rashi could have said in the creativity of Pshuto, just do the intention of the author and you'll be fine. But then he's going to say, no, you're going to miss out. Okay? Everyone clear? So now I return to the question I asked before. What happened in the 10th century? Camille, you already gave a hint to it. What happened in the 10th century that in the 11th century that made people say, you know what, it's not enough to just study Shas, Bavli, Yushalmi, Mechotas, Yifra, Sifrei, Mitzhrabi, Mitzhtan, Chuma, and all these other Midrashim that we have in the Targumim? Let's present Shas to the people. What happened? So I will suggest to you here two different interpretations. One on this board that is internal, something that was happening within the Jewish people, and one that was external, something that happened outside of our community. Amelia mentioned the external explanation. I'm going to start with the internal explanation. And the internal explanation only comes to light recently. Are you familiar with something called the Cairo Geniza? I just did a course in Cairo. I took two semesters in graduate school studying the Cairo Geniza. In the beginning of the 20th century, over 1 million pages was found underground in an Egyptian vault in a city called Fostat, which was the ancient Cairo. It was the Rambam's shul. What was 1 million pages doing in the Rambam's shul? Maybe that was his private library. More likely, what happened was that Christians throughout Europe were destroying Jewish works. A lot of Ashkenazic works are in this Geniza too. And Jews sent, rather than have the Christians destroy them, they sent them on caravans to take to Egypt to store there. They found Torahs, they found Sfarim, they found so much material. 1 million pages, quite a bit. Okay, Solomon Schachter, you've heard of him. He was the person put in charge of categorizing them and cataloging them and the best of determining what these pages are. Okay? By the time he found them, many of those pages were 1,000 years old. What preserved them is the same thing that preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls. The place where they were was very dry land. Never rained there. So it's very dry land. It means that you don't have worms underground who are going to eat away the paper. And for 1,000 years, in a Geniza, in a place where it rains, the water will seep through, will damage everything, even if it's 10 feet below. And there are worms and insects under it, but if it's very dry, worms can't exist in such an environment, and the pages survive. Okay? So, we see that in the Cairo Geniza, some of which is written in the 9th century, 10th century, 11th century, in the Cairo Geniza, we see an amazing array of material, commentaries, Talmuds, Tanakhs, of course. But we also see responsa, questions. They're sent to rabbis. We've heard, responsa, Shalos Chubas, right? And we see that, and we can date them, because they usually put a date on a chuba, right? And this is an opinion put forth by a great biblical scholar of the middle of the 20th century. His name was Mem Tzadik Segel, Moshe Segel, right? And he says that what happened is that we see the Geniza start to produce hundreds, thousands of communications, which wasn't like the average Shaila. Rabbi, my half-brother passed away. Do I have to sit Shiva? Not everyone knows the answer to that question. Right? The questions now, we see a plethora of such questions, which is, Rabbi, I don't know how to interpret this Gemara. Can you explain it to me? Mostly Gemaras. Okay, you see what's happening? Hundreds of questions where people start to want to know not just what's the bottom line of Gemara, which is another way of saying, what should I do? Right? The answer to the question I just raised is Beferish Gemara in Mesechta Moed Katan, in the third paragraph. Right? Jews weren't all schooled in knowing what, you know, they wanted the bottom line of the Gemara, which was, what should I do? What's the halacha? Right? Those were usually the kind of response of, what's the halacha? What should I do? But now we see a plethora of questions where people don't want to just know what's the halacha. They want to know how to interpret the Gemara. That gave rise to commentaries before Rashi. Riff, Rabbeinu Hananel, right? Rashi was part of that. And then what happened there was, hey, wait a second. If we want to give, if you hear, what's the pshat in the Gemara, right? If we want to give the explanation of the Gemara, what naturally followed 100 years later was, finish my sentence, the explanation of the pshat of the Tanakh. Why shouldn't we try to get a commentary to the Torah? If we're getting commentaries to the Gemara, which explains how you see the godless of this. Why the early great commentaries to the Gemara also wrote commentaries to the Torah. Think of Rashi. And after Rashi wrote on the Torah, the next step is write on the Vayim and Ksuvim too. Right? So can you all articulate this interpretation of what led to pshat commentaries to the Tanakh in the 10th century, 10th, 11th century, is that when questions start to be asked, what is the pshat of this Gemara, right? What does the Gemara mean? Not just what should I do, right? People started to ask the question, what does this pasuk mean? So commentary, what does the Gemara mean? Just it was a natural outcome of that. What does the pasuk mean? Everyone clear with that? Everyone good? I think that might be like a polemic with Karaites. Karaites were very powerful at the time. Let me take off and digress for a moment about that. I think there is... No, I don't have it on the syllabus, but it definitely belongs here in week one. Karaites are the probably the spiritual descendants of the Tzedukim. You've heard of Tzedukim in the Gemara, right? What was the defining feature of the Tzedukim in terms of biblical interpretation?
Only pshat.
Only. I spent two semesters studying Karaite literature too. They only do the pshat. They have no oral tradition. The Karaites have no oral tradition. They just determine the interpretation of the Torah based on the pshat. Okay, Karaites eat on Yom Kippur. You know why? Come on, it should be obvious why. The Torah doesn't literally say don't eat on Yom Kippur. What does it say in the Torah?
You should afflict yourself.
Afflict yourselves on Yom Kippur. You should see what Karaites do on Yom Kippur. They like beat each other. They stand at the beginning of Yom Kippur and they do not move until they physically collapse. Because you have to afflict yourself, you get it? Like the Shiites, they not put rocks on their head. Right? They don't leave the house on Shabbos. Right? Because it says, Lo Titzu, don't leave your domain. The Gemara understands that to mean don't leave the Tchum Shabbos. Or don't carry on Shabbos. They don't leave their house on Shabbos. They don't light a fire on Shabbos, even before. No hot food. Right? Because it says, Lo Tivar Reish B'chol Moshe Osechem B'yom HaShabbos. We take that to mean, don't light the fire on Shabbos, but you can light it before Shabbos. Okay? So, Karaites were, at that time, some at some points during the time of Sadigon and after, were more numerous than the Jews, what we call the Jews who keep Torah Shabbat Peh, Rabbinites. They accept rabbinic Judaism, get it? Meaning rabbinic interpretation.
Okay?
That's good. So this might be because of you asked the question, why do I need to read Rashi? Why shouldn't I just get the pshat myself? Right? Because Rashi, and by the way, Ibn Ezra also, and even Rishpam, they wrote their commentaries with a certain assumption of staying within the boundaries of rabbinic interpretation. Sometimes more than others. Some succeeded better than others. But I'll give an example. Karaites eat milk and meat together. By the way, the mitzvahs they keep, they're very strict with. Right? My father knew Karaites in Europe. It's very, very damning that they tried to collaborate with the Nazis, saying that they were not Jewish. Incriminating. The Nazis killed them too. Jewish enough for them. But they tried to pass off as not Jewish. Which is very, very... Well, look, the Mishnah Berurah paskins that they're not Jewish. So they said, okay, we're not Jewish.
Nazis wouldn't care about that.
But they're not, right?
Like, Nazis wouldn't care about that, though.
And of course not.
Are they
or not? The question... I think normative halacha today would say that they're Jewish. Jewish, they follow Torah. They're very strict about Torah. Okay? About what's clearly written in Torah. Why do they eat milk and meat together? This week's parsha.
Because it says don't boil a kid.
Don't boil milk and meat together. But they'll eat a bologna and cheese sandwich. It doesn't say don't eat them together. It says don't cook them together. You get it? Everyone clear? Alright? The Gemara admits that without Torah Shabbat Peh, we would have an unrecognizable observance. You get it? Torah never says to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Do you know that? It says blow shofar on Yom Kippur of Yovel year. All right, and through Gzeirah Shavah, we learn that it also applies to Rosh Hashanah. Without Torah Shabbat Peh, what are we? We're not Karaites. Right? Okay, clear. So I hope that answers your question. And the Karaites have a creed. Their creed is Chapisu be'oraisa shapir. It's in Aramaic. Look through the Torah. But altishanu al dati. Don't rely on my opinion. You make your own opinion about how you keep the Torah. That's chaos.
Well,
almost
starting to talk together. Like these are intelligent people. You think that they look at
So I'll tell you this, that if you read Karaite literature, and I studied 2 years, their halachic works read like Gemara. I don't have time now to discuss some of their interpretations. There's some really wild interpretations of how they come to their practices. Would anyone like to take an educated guess how many mitzvahs the Karaites have in the Torah? They have the same Torah we have. They revere it. How many mitzvahs do they have? Take an educated guess from our discussion.
10? If they only count the decalogue.
No, that's Christians. They count the Ten Commandments. Yes, what do you think?
They just keep the shadow mitzvah to be off.
No. They wear tefillin. But you know what their tefillin looks like? It's a little string around the finger and the hand right here. This is yodecha. So they just wear tefillin here. Okay? And they have a little like a chain around their head with a small little ball in there that says Yetzias Mitzrayim on it. That's Karaite. And they wear it all day. Okay? How many mitzvahs? What do you think? They don't need chametz on Pesach. And they bring a korban Pesach.
Is it more than?
A lot less. They only have about 200. Because they haven't figured them out. They haven't figured them out. they have when an accepted rabbinic scholar, a Karaite rabbinic scholar, actually figures out a mitzvah that's accepted, they have like a big party about it. Okay? The fact that there are no more Karaites, and it's not because of bad will on our part. Karaites were very much against Rabbinites in the Middle Ages. They colluded with them, especially the Muslims. Christians just killed everybody, but the Muslims favored the Karaites. Because the Karaites have a lunar calendar that's not corrected by the solar. Like Muslims, right? The Muslim, you know that? The, what do you call the whole month? Ramadan. It's fluctuating. Right? It could be in the summer, it could be in the winter. Right? Karaites look much more like Islam than Rabbinism, and the Karaites often colluded with the Muslims against the Rabbinites. Obviously, I'm very much, you know, biased against Karaism, but the fact that there aren't any more of them, when at the time that I'm talking now, when this is happening, they outnumbered us. By us, I mean the Rabbinites, those who accept the Talmud. They reject the Talmud. Okay? By the way, with one fascinating thing, they are just crazy light years more machmir than we are, is in the laws of Tumah. Tumah and Tahara. Why? Because there's certain psukim in the Torah. This week's Parsha has one. Rashi mentions, this is not talking about all the Jews, it's only talking about the Kohanim and only up at the time of the holidays. That they have to keep this level of Tahara. Right? But especially at the end of Parshas Tzav and Parshas Shmini, Rashi keeps writing. The Gemara says that this is not literal, and this is only for the holiday time, and it's only for Kohanim. Because if you keep the strict letter of the Torah, like Siddukim, like Karaites, you have to wear gloves and it's COVID all the time to stay away from Tumah. Okay? And they do that. It's crazy. Right? Which should give us pause. Right? The New Testament refers to the Jews, the Talmudic Jews, as Pharisees. You've heard of that? Mm-hmm. Pharisees, you met familiar? Sadducees are the Tzedukim, the Pharisees, and what does the Gemara call them? Parushim, right? Parushim, why are we called that? Why is Rabbi Yeshua Rabbi Akiva? Why are they Parushim? What's the traditional interpretation that everyone gives for why we're called Pharisees? Is this the first time you're hearing that word?
No. Because of the word of law, Perush.
Yes, because of Perush. The Perush of oral law. You get it? Because the traditional explanation is we are Perushim Mituma, that we separated from Tuma, but that's not appropriate. Based on the Dead Sea Scrolls, what we see, the Dead Sea Scrolls also have no Torah Shabbat. They're like Tzedukim, Dead Sea Scrolls, Tzedukim, Karaites. It's one long train. There's a book written on that topic, a great book. It's called Karaism and the Judean Scrolls. It's written by a man named Naftali Weider. It's excellent, excellent historical material telling like 1,500-year story of Jews who interpret the Torah without oral interpretation. Right? And those people are very crazy machmir on the laws of purity and impurity, Tumah and Tahara. So to say we're Parushim because we're Parush Mituma misses the point. The Tzedukim are more Parushim Mituma than we are, and so are the Karaites. So it must be a different reason why we're called Parushim, which is Perush. You give Perush to the Torah. Ayin tachas ayin? No, you have to give Perush to that. It's not an eye for an eye. That would be ayin be'ayin, like we said before, an ayin le'ayin. Ayin tachas ayin means something else. And especially since the Torah says, v'nosato ayin tachas ayin. Talk to me. V'nosato, what does that imply? You shall give an eye for an eye. Would anyone think the absurdity of a law code that says, if Chas v'Shalom I take out Ruvain's eye, that I have to give him my eye? No. What does it mean, v'nosato ayin tachas ayin? Give him the money, the work he's losing for that, the embarrassment he's suffering for that, that's a lot of money. Right? You get it, the nosaka ayin tachasayin. Here? Okay. The Torah has a way of getting the right interpretation, even from the pshat that's written. Now, I want to close out today's class with the external explanation. Does everybody feel comfortable here writing a paragraph, just briefly? What would be an internal reason why Jews started to give pshat interpretation after 1,000 years of studying the biblical text from the standpoint of Shas Bavli, Rishani, Midrashi Halacha, Midrashi Agad? Right? The Cairo Geniza, we started to want to learn the pshat of the Gemara, so we started to learn the pshat of the Torah. Right? But be careful, because the Karaites have, you know, only do pshat. Right? So don't just rely on everybody's individual pshat. You have to be steeped in grammar, you have to be steeped in philology. Philology means the meaning of a word. Right? You have to do a lot to know what, how to figure out pshat. Right? Did anyone think of interpreting the U.S. Constitution with drash? Who are the conservatives and who are the liberals when it comes to interpreting the Torah, the way we divided the Constitution? The conservatives are the Karaites. They want the simple, just give me the words. I don't mean to do this with political undertones. When I say Rabbi Akiva was the most liberal of darshanim, I mean that he took liberties with the meaning of the words. Right? Those are the crowns on the letters that Rabbi Akiva put. You know, he's very liberal. You see, there's so much you can do with this, with his interpretations. You get it? The text says more for Rabbi Akiva. That's what made him so popular. That's what made Rashi so popular. Right? Pshat is usually limited to, no, one or two things. Breathless can just mean so many things in pshat. Okay? You hear it? Okay. Now let's talk about the external reason. I know I don't have a whole lot of time, but this is going to be far more interesting. Okay? I mentioned the word philology before. Right? It's an easy English word. Just remember it. Philology means the meaning of the words. Okay? Mashmaut is philology. Okay? Okay? You can't give pshat if you don't know the meaning of the words. Right? What else does pshat need?
Context.
Grammar. Context. Very important. Context. Grammar. Reality. Your pshat should be based in reality. Right? So I would tell you there are four building blocks of pshat that become enmeshed in the Jewish community through an external reason. They are philology, grammar, context, reality. And I'm going to give you a real live example of this. Okay? This is something I used to do way back in my yeshiva days in Israel. I used to, what's called polemicize. You see what the word means? Polemicize with evangelicals. Right? In the summertime, there are a lot of them in the subway system. They're standing on crates trying to convince every audience that the Tanakh predicts the coming of Jesus. Right? One of the most fundamental prophecies that Christians claim is the virgin birth of Jesus, predicted in the book of Yeshayahu, chapter 7, verse 14. Okay? Because Yeshayahu, when speaking about the salvation of his people, he writes, Hine ha'alma hora violetic ben. That child shall save you. And Jews were forced into disputations. See, this explanation has something preferable to the first explanation, because it explains why did this happen now, before Rashi. Because Christian theology teaches, maybe you're not old enough to remember the second time this happened, but I am, that Jesus can come year 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, now come or in between. But the new millennia is more ripe for that. Maybe you remember Y2K, they said the coming of Jesus is that all the computers are going to break down because they were written for 1900 instead of 2000. Right? You probably read about that. I suspect that some of you weren't really even alive in the year 2000. So this was happening. A lot of evangelical activity goes on in the year 1000. It produced the Crusades. Okay? And Rashi was in the middle of that. So Jews were forced into, they never wanted it, because you didn't know what was worse. Losing the disputation, in which case they might banish you. So if you lost the disputation, why aren't you converted? Or winning a disputation. Because if the Jew won the disputation, they would often kill the people who took part for being disrespectful to Christianity. So we don't have that concern here in this class. Of course, I'm biased here. But if a Christian wants to use these words, behold, the virgin will give birth to a son, and he will save you. That's what Yeshayahu is talking about, right? This child is going to save you. And a Jew is forced to respond to that. How can you continue your stubborn swimming against the tide of history with all your suffering? You don't see that you should just come along. You know, they said, don't join the Muslims. The Muslims don't revere your book, but we do. Right? Christian loves Voracious. They love Leviticus. Why they don't actually keep the mitzvahs is a separate polemic. But this particular polemic is, does this verse refer to the virgin birth of Jesus? Okay, Hinei ha'alma, it's Yeshayahu 7:14. Yeshayahu 7:14. So what's the first debate that Jews had about this pasuk? Hinei ha'alma ha'ravi yoledet ben. The virgin shall give birth to a child. And the rest of the pasukim do talk about that child will save you and that child will. We'll correct the whatever's bad. What's the first thing you have to do? Come on, look at the philology, meaning of words.
Alma.
What does the word alma mean? It's an unusual Hebrew word. So what do you do?
Come on, do the scientific.
Look at where else it appears. Stay with me here. Come on, be active. Stay with us. All right. Look where else this word appears. It's a rare word in the Bible. It appears all of 5 times in the entire Bible. Okay, Alma. In its male form, it appears more often. Elem. An Elem is a young boy. An Alma is a young girl. Okay? It describes Rivka, getting water for a stranger. It describes Miriam, putting her brother in a basket. It describes young women who are married to the king in Shir HaShirim. It describes a married woman in Sefer Mishle. And here is number 5. The Alma who's going to give birth to a child. Now, do you in this class know a better Hebrew word that fits the Christian theology of what this pasuk says according to them?
Besula,
no? Right? In fact, here is a real kicker. When Rivka is described getting the water, she's described as an Alma Besula. What does Alma mean?
Young maiden.
Alma is descriptive of age. Besula is not descriptive of age. Right? Alma has nothing to say about the sexual experience of the woman it's mentioned. Neither does Elam for the boy. You following? If this was meant to be, the Jews would say, if this was meant to be a prediction of the virgin birth of Jesus, then you have the wrong Hebrew word. Now you see, in the Greek translation, in the King James version of the Bible, the word is always behold. It's in English. They write, behold, the virgin shall give birth to him. So if you're reading it in English, you see what you're reading. You're reading it to fit the theology of Christianity. But that's not the original Hebrew. Even the New Testament was originally written in Hebrew and then translated to Greek. They don't even have the original Hebrew. So much can be lost in translation. Right? So the first thing they did, that can't be the meaning of this prophecy because you are wrong philologically. That's not what the word means. Yes, what was it?
Yeah, to play the devil's advocate, just to throw it out there. Not that, you know.
I get it, yeah.
But if it's a young maiden, depending on which age it is, and it's a Jewish lady, and because...
But in Mishlei, the word Alma describes a married woman.
Oh.
To base a new religion on this...
Yeah, it's a little sketchy.
Do any of you have any, let's say, football imagery in your mind? That now they do it in baseball too, is that the coach can challenge a call on the field, and then they go and look at a camera and they look in from all angles, right?
Yeah.
You're familiar with such a thing, right? So would you agree that the benchmark for changing a call made on the field has to have more careful scrutiny than the original call?
Yeah.
Like when overturning a verdict. Would you agree?
Yeah.
So if you, Christianity, you want to say that God took a physical form, put himself in the body of a woman, and was born to a virgin, then it better be better than just the possible meaning of what Alma could mean. Alma has nothing to do with Basula. That's a different Hebrew word. Rivka is called an Alma Basula. That would be absurd to say that Alma means Basula. Right? You ready to go? Right? Okay, philology. Grammar. I'll do this quickly now. Hara means... Anybody? In Chahara, what do you say? Is pregnant. Not will be pregnant 600 years from now. So grammar. Hara. Wrong. Dahlia said context. Very important. What is this prophecy? None of you thought of asking? What is this? What is he talking about? There's a whole background to this prophecy. Suffice it to say that Yehuda was facing a mortal threat from the north. And the king of Yehuda wanted to do a certain thing to face this threat. And Yeshayahu went to tell them, don't do that. What you're thinking of doing is not a good idea. Rather, what you should do is have faith in this boy who's going to save you. Now, context. What good would it do for Ochaz to have faith because some 600 years from now, arguably, the son of a virgin is going to save the Jews? This is a sign for now. Why I shouldn't make a coalition between Aram and the northern tribes. This has to be context. You know what I'm saying? The context indicates that this can't be a reference to Jesus. You following? By the way, there was a famous disputation in the 11th century where a rabbi misspoke at that point after making this argument. And he said, but wait a second. The child here is supposed to save us. Jesus didn't save us. They killed him. The Romans killed him. Where do you have it that he saved us from the Romans? Romans destroyed the temple afterwards. The Romans killed him. The baby in this in this pasuk is supposed to save us. You with me? They killed him for that insolence. Because it sounded disrespectful. Never mind that that's only right. this baby is supposed to save us and inspire you not to join the coalition against Ashur right now. It's not a good idea. Have faith in God. Because, you know why? A maiden is going to give birth to a child, and that child will save you from the Assyrians. That child is Chizkiyah, who did save us from the Assyrians. Okay? The fourth thing is reality. Can you now just close out class with that? New. And by the way, Hine also implies you're going to see it. Hine, behold. Why would someone say behold for something that's happening 600 years from now? You hear it? Even exegetically, now, they have a fifth point. You following? You wouldn't say Hine for something that's happening 600 years from now. No prophet does. Hine means it's happening now in our lifetime. Behold, we're going to see it soon.
So what's their backing on this at all?
So, I'm not here to defend Christianity. Reality, what's the reality? Come on. Virgins don't give birth. Okay. So, if you want, the foundations of Pshat come from the external forcing of Jews into arguing Bible with Christians. What's the end? The Jews had to be always given restrictions. You couldn't say anything blasphemous. You couldn't say anything disrespectful. Only one disputant was able to have free reign. Remember the famous story of Ramban and Pablo Cristiano? He was almost killed for that too, for winning so decisively. Right? You probably have seen a movie about it. The movie is called The Disputation. Great movie. You should try to see it. It's only about an hour and 14 minutes. It's really worthwhile. So, These foundations of Pshat mean that the Jew tells the Christian, what you're trying to do, you're trying to overturn a whole religion, but it's not the Pshat. Overturning a decision made on the field has to be clear and obvious that the ref made the wrong call. Right? Oh my goodness, I called it a home run, but it's so obvious upon closer scrutiny that the ball is foul. Or vice versa. It has to be obvious. You don't start a whole new religion based on the virgin birth that is so spurious philologically, grammatically, contextually, and in reality. Okay? That, I submit to you, is the environment Rashi grew up in, where he said, we have to supply shot for them. Right. Okay, now you see week one on your syllabus. It says Talmud Bavli and Yerushalmi, Midrashim, Halacha and Agada, Targumim, Sa'adigam. Wow, look at week two. Introduction of Pshat. Internal considerations, external considerations. We are flying here. We're going to be finished in 3 weeks. I'll give next class. I'm going to give exercises. We're going to learn. Just I'm going to write one pasuk on the board. I'll get a bad marker next time, and we're going to see how would Rashi interpret this. How would even Ezra interpret this, or Rashban, and then we'll go the next step to Ramban, and then we'll really get our feet wet. Okay, this was a lot of fun. Thank you for being here.